Let us open our Bible, perhaps a 10-minute meditation. Yeah, Mark and I were talking today about our preaching, and he was sharing with me how he was in Ephesians chapter 5, dealing with the role of the husband and the wife in the marriage. And and I was sharing with him how we've been talking about something similar in our church, because we have been meditating through 1 Peter now for a good while. And it's been a real blessing to be able to do that on Sunday morning. And so we've been on chapter 3 of 1 Peter for some time. And in my New King James Bible, this section from verse 1 through 6 or 7, it is entitled Submission to Husbands and then A Word to Husbands. And so I will try to summarize some of the thoughts we've been talking about over the last few weeks. Peter writes, "Likewise, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey to the word, they, without a word, may be won by the conduct of their wives, when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. Do not let your beauty be that of outward adorning, of arranging the hair, wearing of gold, or putting on fine apparel, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. For in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are if you do good and are not afraid with any terror. Likewise, you husbands, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered." So we will, as we summarize, we can only really touch on some of the major thoughts that the Lord gave us as we meditated through this passage. So I'm sure you understand that, you know, behind these major thoughts, there are elaborations and more considerations that could be shared. And I would begin just by what we noticed as we, you know, consider the passage. There is enough here. There is certainly enough here to make many women angry. I mean, there's the words like "be submissive." That's already hard. Even if they do not obey the word, they, without a word, may be won by your conduct. It seems to give the image of a woman that needs to take it no matter what. Just be quiet and take it. And be submissive. And then, of course, the word submissive is repeated again in verse 5. And then, of course, it talks of Sarah calling Abraham Lord. This is so far removed from today's culture. But there's enough matter here, I'm sure, to make many women angry. But also there may be enough matter here to give the impression to some men that, how should we say, that this is pro-man and against women. And as today's women may accuse the Bible of being masculinist, some men may take it as such. In reality, both of these fronts are wrong. This is not about humiliating women, and this is not about exalting men per se. It's really nothing to do with it. all of the terms are used here as submission or obedience or respect or other such terms need to be interpreted in the light of the letter, and they need to be interpreted in the light of the overall thought of the scripture. So that when in our church the first sermon, actually, as I touched on this passage, I went back to Genesis chapter 1. What is the conception the Bible gives us of the woman? And I'm sure that you have done that because Mark told me. And that's exactly what over the last few weeks we've been doing as we approach this passage. Woman, the woman, just as much as man was created in the image of God. And the concept of the man and the woman created in the image of God means that the Bible gives us the highest concept of the value of human life that can be conceived. That both the man and the woman have been created to know, believe, love, and reflect God in all that they are, in all that they think, in all that they feel, and in all that they do. There can be no higher concept of that, of human life, of either sex. So we begin with Genesis. You begin the understanding where Peter is coming from by beginning with the beginning of the Bible. That's how you respect a text if you want to interpret it, you know, correctly. And then, of course, we touched on some of the laws of the Old Testament, as well as in Proverbs chapter 31, where it gives us a picture of the ideal woman. And as you very well know, in Proverbs 31, it speaks of a gracious woman, but also a woman of strength, industrious, a woman that works, a man that is involved, and together with her husband in many different ways, so that we cannot confuse the biblical vision of the woman with the Islamic vision of the woman. The two things are completely different, and we need to help others see that in us, that the two things may not be confused. Of course, after, you know, one pursues the Bible to get a clear understanding of the biblical concept of the woman, then one needs to interpret 1 Peter in its own light, the immediate context, and look at that word in verse 1, likewise, likewise. That word, of course, is a conjunction, but it doesn't mean just therefore or and. It means more than that. It means just like what I've been saying all along, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands. That word likewise means that Peter has already been talking about submission. And submission, not concerning women and then wives, but as you very well know, look at verse 13, speaking to all Christians, submit yourselves to every ordinance, or rather institution of man, for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme or to governors as to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do good. Now, this is very clear. Submission per se is not just relegated to the women as their duty towards their husbands, because all Christians here are called to be submitted to the civil government as an institution of God. And then if you could look downward to verse 18, servants, again, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to those who are gentle and good, but also to those who are harsh, for this is commendable in the sight of God. Again, Notice here that submission is required of men. Men. Servants, that's masculine. Servants. It could be interpreted, you know, generically, servants, male or female, but the word is masculine, and the emphasis is masculine. So that if you work for somebody, if you are employed by somebody, you men, you need to be submissive. You need to respect those who are above you, those who have hold a place of responsibility and authority over you. So whether, you know, politically towards your government or as far as your work ethics in the work environment and responsibility, submission is necessary. Even if we move out of here and go to chapter 5, look at what we find in chapter 5. Talking about the local church, verse 5, likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. Notice here that doesn't say young girls or young women, but it says younger people. Submit yourselves to your elders. Now, the word elders could be interpreted whether the pastors or people that are older than you in age, but apart from how you interpret it, the quality or the value of submission is again spoken of here and is recommended to all young people that profess to know the Lord. And then it says, yes, all of you be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. Now that, all of you, he's just spoken of younger people and older people. And yet, there seems to be a way in which we can live with a measure of submission to one another. You know, perhaps there is a way in which an elderly man could be submitted to a younger person. You know, perhaps that younger person has abilities that the older person doesn't have, and the older person can recognize that. You know, perhaps there are spaces in the home where the husbands should not do very much or stay out of, because they belong to the woman. It's her responsibilities. And a husband can submit to, let's say, a word or a counsel or an idea or an opinion that the wife expresses about matters that she knows about, and we hardly know a thing. That all of you be submitted to one another must mean that there is a way in which submission is a quality that should characterize all of us. Every one of us recognizes our responsibilities. If we are husbands and we have certain responsibilities, and that role should be recognized, the authority belonging to that role should be recognized. But the women also have responsibilities in their authority, in their field. That should be recognized as well. That is a strong word. All of you be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. So it is a submission that comes from humility. It is not something you swallow, like, I'm just going to have to take this, you know, I have to bear with it. No, it must come out of humility, an understanding of your limits, and a critical and proper evaluation of your abilities or disabilities, of what you can do, what you cannot do. And, of course, everybody's being, you know, dependent on God. And then if we go back to chapter 3, perhaps a few more thoughts. So we saw that this submission is not something that just belongs to the woman per se. It is a quality that is called for all Christians, must be in all Christians. Then it says, look at that, likewise, and we said that word is so important, because this is a continuation of what he's been saying all along, talking about submission. He said, be submissive to your own husbands. Now, that your own is in the original text, which means that, from my point of view, I'm not infallible, But it would seem to me like a woman is not really to be submitted to all men. To your, not your husband, but your own husbands. So a man has no business dictating things to a woman just because she's a woman. I really don't see that in Scripture. And there's a limit, therefore, to a man's authority over the womankind. Be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they, without a word, may be won by the conduct of their wives. Now, this is such a powerful message. Now, we could get the impression that Peter here is downplaying the importance of words as necessary to be converted. But now, look at it very carefully. Even if some do not obey the word, so even if you as a woman find yourself in a situation where your husband is not a believer, then what are you to do? And Peter says that they can be gained to the faith without a word. What is he saying? He's not saying that they can be saved without the word of the gospel, because he had just said that they refused the word of the gospel. And in chapter, actually in chapter 1, and we're speaking about verse 23, Peter has already said that the new birth cannot take place without that incorruptible seed of the word. So the word of the gospel is necessary to be saved. That word of the gospel must be communicated to the husbands. Now, he may not listen to it. He may disobey it. He may disregard it. But it must be communicated. But again, go back to chapter 3 and verse 1. What actually Peter is saying is that the only indispensable word that is necessary to save your husband, your unbelieving husband, or your unbelieving wife, is the word of the gospel. Your word is not absolutely necessary. His word is absolutely necessary. So, if one finds himself married to a person who's not a believer, he or she is not to think that unless I'm able to articulate my faith, unless I'm able to speak out my faith, unless I'm able day to day to communicate and to push it and to try to make him reason and make him think, he's never going to be converted. That's not true. That's not true. The only thing that is necessary, absolutely, is the word of the gospel. Our words, the added things that we can say about our own experience, our own conversion, or explaining more in detail, is an extra that is important if the Lord allows it, gives the context, the relationship that allows for that dialogue. But if he doesn't listen, Peter says, the important thing is that he served the gospel. That's enough. That's enough to save him. God can use that. And then use your word if God works in such a way as to open the possibility of a dialogue. But if your evangelical words only make him madder and more upset, and perhaps lead him to curse the name of God and to trample those pearls under his feet just like a swine would do, then the Lord, Peter says, just be quiet, don't worry. Now Peter says, without a word, so without your word, with the word of the gospel, without your word, your husband can be gained. Now that word gained is passive in the original, which means that in spite of the fact that you can't talk to your husband because he won't listen, you can still do something that God can use to convert your husband. And he says that he may be won by the conduct of their wives. And this is a wonderful thing. We have reasoned about this time and time again. What Peter is saying is simply this, in some ways. Do not think that the only way to communicate Christ to your husband is through your words. Do not think that if you can't express it in words, you can't express it at all. The communication verbal communication is not the only kind of communication through which you can communicate to your husband. Verbal communication can be understood by the ears. That's why they were given, so that we can hear words and make sense. But the Lord has also given us eyes to see. And if your husband, unbelieving husband or unbelieving wife, is not willing to hear and has become deaf, you can still live in such a way that they will see how you live, so that you can continue to communicate Christ, not so much in words perhaps, but in what you do, in how you live. When you think about it, this is exactly what God does. We know that God communicates in words. He has spoken through His Word. But is the spoken Word the only way in which God communicates? Doesn't Psalm 19 says that the heavens declare the glory of God? That Psalm says they don't really speak words per se, but they do communicate. So God communicates with words and apart from words through what He does. By showing His glory in what He does, in what He displays. And so, like Peter says, you can do the same. Don't think that because you can't speak, you can no longer witness to your husband or your wife. You can still do that by the way that you live. By the way that you live. And then, of course, a good meditation would be, which is more valuable? Words or deeds? Words without deeds? Mm-mm. Not acceptable. Not acceptable. Deeds without words? Acceptable. Acceptable. So in some way, deeds are more valuable than words, because they can even do without words once the gospel is preached. They can still see Christ in you by the way that you live, Peter says. In fact, he says in verse 2, when they observe the chaste conduct accompanied by fear. So when they observe, they may not want to use their ears, but they can't really blind themselves. So you can still witness. You can still help your husbands or wives to see Christ in you, though you may not speak, because it's not conducive to a good dialogue. And notice that in chapter 2, Peter had already spoken about this. Verse 12. Having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. You see that? Peter had already counseled the same thing to all Christians. It is by your conduct that you can turn the judgments of others against you when they see the way that you live. And if you go downward again in verse 18, he repeats the same thing. Be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh. For this is commendable if because of your conscience toward God, one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what credit is it if when you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently, but when you do good and suffer for it? Now look at that. When you do good and suffer for it, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. So this is again the value and the importance and the power of the Christian life, Christian conduct, Christian love. in spite of the maltreatment, in spite of the abuse, in spite of the offenses. So this, when Peter says women are to be silent or they can gain their husbands without speaking, it's not degrading the woman at all. He's been saying the same thing to all Christians. When they will not hear your words, you can still testify by the way that you live. And by the way, if you scroll down just a little bit, we get to the very heart of the matter, where when he says, verse 21, "For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps, who committed no sin, nor was guile found in his mouth." And then look at 23. "When he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed to him who judges righteously." See, the greatest example, of course, is Christ. In other words, he's saying, I am not saying this because I want to degrade women who are to take everything and bear everything without saying a word. That's not what he's talking about. He's saying that Christ has done that. Christ says he took it and he took it and it did not respond because they couldn't hear him. They would not hear him. So there is an evangelical root in the back of this Christian behavior that is not tied to legalism. It is tied to the very heart of the gospel. And what greater way to reflect Christ when you love though you're not loved? When you treat kindly, when you're treated unkindly, when you speak with patience, when you are offended, that is Christ's likeness. You don't need to speak necessarily. Not a Christian doesn't need to speak necessarily. But as we said, words without deed are not good. But deeds without words, if that's all that you can do, are still mighty. Are still mighty. He can see Christ in you, or she can see Christ in you. And that's what they need to see. And again, very quickly, chapter 3, Peter says then in verse 3, "Do not let your beauty be that outward adorning of arranging of the hair, wearing gold or putting on fine apparel." And one could ask, why in the world is Peter talking about this now? He's talking about the situation here of difficulty of a woman married to a husband who's not a Christian. Why is he talking about apparel and the hair and the gold and the and things like that? He's talking about this because he just now look at verse 1. He says that the husband may be won by the conduct of their wives. You want to gain your husband. You want to gain your husband. You want to win him. But how are you going to do that? And Peter says, what you need to focus is, it's not on the outward appearance to gain your husband in that sense. That's not going to resolve your problem. So the stress is not to be put on your image as a woman, your femininity. And I would say, Mark, I don't know, I think you would agree. I don't believe Peter is condemning per se any sort of what he calls gold or fine apparel. I think there is a place for that. I think if you look at the overall Bible, and I love to think of Ezekiel 16, when God, in describing Israel, describes how God adorned Israel and all sorts of jewelry and beauty. There's a limit to that. There's a limit to that. I think simplicity. I think there's a place for femininity and all of that in a moderate fashion, which is part of being a woman anyway. But what Peter is saying is that the emphasis is not to be that. To gain your husband physically or emotionally or sentimentally, it's not what's necessary here as much as to gain him spiritually. And to be able to gain him spiritually, jewelry is not going to be, it's not going to do the job. What he needs to see is the hidden person of the heart, the incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is the precious, is very precious in the sight of God. So the emphasis in a situation of that kind of situation, difficult situation, is the inward. It's not the outward, it's the inward. In spite of the offenses and the disregard and the disrespect, and I believe there's a point where the church can step in case of severe abuse. I don't think a woman should be subjected to unending abuse, excessive abuse, because then you step into a realm of law when, you know, that needs to stop. But to a certain point, at least, and in any case, as far as the woman is concerned, she needs to really take care of her heart, the hidden person of the heart, the incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. That's Christ-like. That's Christ-likeness. Now the question is, how do you do it? And as I end my thoughts here, how do you do it? How do you do it every day? Day in and day out. How do you bear with this situation? Because the woman can say, you know, I am human. I have limits. I can't take this anymore. And I think there is a limit, as we already said, in terms of the church intervening, or even sometimes authorities intervening, when you talk of physical abuse or things like that. But in verse 11 of chapter 2, I think that we gain a very precious encouragement from Peter. It's a strategic value in the warfare. This is actually the first verse with which Peter enters into these areas of difficulties in the Christian life, as far as this letter is concerned. Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. That's it. When in this letter Peter enters into situations of difficulty, the spiritual warfare, he will speak of the issues of the civil government, harsh masters, harsh husbands, but the first difficulty is not those of the outward circumstances of life, it's the struggle with our inner sin. The fleshly lust which war against the soul. So what happens is when your husband mistreats you, so many times you would like to respond. Your fleshly lust say, you just need to give it to him. Treat him as he treats you. So there is a retaliation, a spirit of retaliation that takes over. And in this regard, that's where the battle is won or lost. So, you know, Peter says that when you find yourself before a mate that is not a believer, to be able to keep that composure of spirit of meekness and love, you need to abstain from fleshly lusts. You need to win the war within on a daily basis. If you let hurts accumulate, then you will explode or implode. It will come the time when you will not be able to take it anymore. But if you, on a daily basis, you pour your soul out to God, as Christ did, because the text that we have read, verse 23 says, he not only did not respond, but the word is entrusted, committed, entrusted. And the original text doesn't say entrusted himself, but he entrusted the whole matter to the Father. So he did not vindicate himself, but he let the Father vindicate him at the right time. And that's what we are to do. I'm sure that you noticed that Peter in chapter 3 dedicates 6 verses to the woman and 1 verse to the man. And that too can be objected, you know. Why does he do this? You know, the Bible is biased against women. No, that's not the case. Remember that in Ephesians, Paul does the very opposite. And Paul speaks much more to men than to women in Ephesians. So the reason why here Peter spends many more verses about the woman, you know why? Well, verse 7. You husbands, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. Peter here is talking about all sorts of difficult situations. Working for harsh masters, or working for a difficult president. And he's talking about a woman who finds herself married to a lost husband. And Peter spends more time counseling with the woman because he cares. Because he's compassionate. That's why he spends more time. Not because he's anti-feminist. That's got nothing to do with it at all. The apostle here comes to the rescue of the woman who finds herself in a difficult situation, spending much more time to give her good counsel so she may know how she is to face and to live as a Christian in such a situation. And it will be. And as I end my thoughts, my quick thoughts, I cannot but just share this with you. Why? Why does God sometimes put us in situations so difficult? And I believe anymore. And that anymore means that scripture plus experience. If I may say it that way. Because He puts us in the furnace at times because that is the instrument He's going to use us to mold us and change us in the image of Christ. Like Peter says, this is how he was, this is how he behaved, and he was Christ. Now, how can we learn to be like him if we're not put in the furnace? If everything goes well, if we are not put sometimes in difficult daily situations, and to know the love of Christ, and to know what it means to love as He loved, to give up His honor and His glory for the sake of loving us, that we may be saved. That's what Peter is saying. Remember that your husband is lost, and he needs to be rescued. He needs to be won. The same argument of Paul when he says, do not abandon your husband. How do you know that God is not going to use you to save him? So the honor of marriage is to be preserved. And this is the last word with which I ended my last message on 1 Peter chapter 3. It is not marriage that needs to be changed for our sake. But it's us who need to be changed by keeping marriage what it is. We do not need to adapt marriage according to our whims. That bond, that promise is holy. We need to be changed. We need to change that bond may be honored. And, I trust these simple thoughts will have been an encouragement to you. I think they have been to us. We have a number of women that live in that sort of situation with alcoholic husbands or unbelieving husbands. So we spend extra time on 1 Peter chapter 3. Amen.